their minds. The city groaned and shook to life. Major Mark Mitchell heard the news at headquarters 9 miles away and thought, "You're kidding. We got bad guys at the wire?" He ran downstairs looking for Master Sergeant Dave Betts. Maybe he would know what was happening. But Betts didn't know anything. He blustered, "One of the agency guys came down and told us we got 600 Taliban surrendering. Can you believe that?" Surrendering? Mitchell couldn't figure out why. He thought the Taliban had fled from the approaching forces of the Northern Alliance to Kunduz, miles away. American Special Forces and the Northern Alliance had been beating them back for weeks, in battle after battle, rolling up territory by coordinating airstrikes from the sky and thousands of Northern Alliance soldiers on the ground. They now stood on the verge of total victory. Kunduz was where the war was supposed to go next. Not here. Not in Mazar. Besides, these guys didn't surrender. They fought to the death. Die fighting, and you went to paradise. Mitchell stood at the dirty plate glass windows and watched. Here they came, packed into 6 big trucks, staring out from the rancid tunnels of their scarves. Mitchell could see their heads over the barricade that ringed his headquarters, a former schoolhouse at the junk-strewn edge of the city. The prisoners, who surely included some Al-Qaeda members, were still literally in the driver's seats, with Northern Alliance soldiers sitting next to them, their AKs pointed at the driver's heads. "Everybody get away from the windows," said Betts. Major Kurt Sontag, Captain Kevin Leahy, Captain Paul Siverson, and a dozen other Special Forces soldiers knelt behind the black and white checked columns in the room, their M4 rifles aimed at the street. Behind them in the kitchen, the local cook was puttering. The air smelled of cooked rice and cucumber. And a radio was playing more of that god-awful Afghan music that sounded to Mitchell like somebody strangling a goose. He'd been looking forward this morning to overseeing the construction of the medical facility in town and the further blowing up of mines and bombs that littered the area like confetti. Each day, a little bit more of the war seemed to be ending. Mitchell had even started to wonder when he would get to go home. He and a team of about a dozen Special Forces soldiers had moved into the schoolhouse only 48 hours earlier. Their former headquarters inside the Kale-i-Jangi Fortress, 9 miles off, in Mazar's western quarter, had given them the shits, the croup, and the flu, and Mitchell was glad to have moved out. It seemed a haunted place. Known as the House of War, the fortress rose like a mud golem from the desert, surrounded by struggling plots of wind-whipped corn and sparse cucumber. Its walls towered 60 feet high and measured 30 feet thick. The Taliban had occupied the fortress for 7 years and filled it with weapons, grenades, rockets, and firearms, anything made for killing. Before their hurried flight from the city 2 weeks earlier, the Taliban had left the weapons and smeared feces on the walls and windows. Every photograph, every painting, every rose bush had been torn up, smashed, stomped, ruined. After 3 years of Taliban rule, there were old men in Mazar with stumps for hands. There were women who'd been routinely stoned and kicked on street corners. Young men who'd been imprisoned for not wearing beards. Fathers who'd been beaten in front of their sons for the apparent pleasure of those swinging their weapons. The arrival of Mitchell and his soldiers on horseback had put an end to that. The locals had welcomed the balding, blue-eyed Mitchell and 2 dozen other Special Forces soldiers in a mile-long parade lining the highway that dropped into town out of the snowy mountains. Mitchell had felt like he was back in World War II, his grandfather's war, riding into Paris after the Nazis fled. Now 36, Mitchell was the ground commander of the 5th Special Forces Group, 3rd Battalion's Ford Operating Base, FOB. It had been a distinguished nearly 15-year career headed for the top of the military food chain. His best friend, Major Kurt Sontag, a 37-year-old weekend surfer from Los Angeles, was the FOB's executive officer, which technically meant he was Mitchell's boss. In the tradition of Special Forces, they treated each other as equals. Nobody saluted. Looking at the street now, Mitchell tried to figure out why the Taliban convoy was stopping. If anything went bad, Mitchell knew he was woefully outnumbered. He had maybe a dozen guys he could call on, and those like Leahy and Siverson weren't exactly hardened killers. Like him, these were staff guys in their mid-30s, soldiers who had until now been largely warless. He did have a handful of CIA operators living upstairs in the schoolhouse, and 8 Brits, part of a special boat service unit who'd landed the night